Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of the Create More podcast with me, Ben Stewart. This fortnight's episode will be with Jason Bruges, who have a fantastic design studio in Old Street and who specialise in interactive installations. It was great to go around. I got the chance to go to the studio. This was fresh off the back of their trip to Cannes, where they did some amazing work with a massive full-size digital lion that reacted to the emotion of Twitter. So if that doesn't lure you in to listen to the rest of the podcast, I don't know what will. But I'm going to give you a little bit more background as well, because the studio was formed in 2002, and they've expanded. They're well over 20 people now. And when I went through the office, you know, they introduced me to their architects, lighting designers, they've got electrical engineers, and they've done all sorts of work. I mean, from 2002 to now, they've worked all over the world. They've done projects for the Olympics. They've won numerous awards. They've worked with Channel 4, with Aston Martin, with Dyson. And they've just done some absolutely stunning work. I mean, visually, it's just spectacular. And kind of really, if you're going to Google something, if you're not listening to this through Acast, which you should be, just Google, go and look up Winterlight, which was 500 LED powered turbines on top of the Hayward Gallery. And these are all on like flexible poles. And at night, it was absolutely beautiful just to see all these things flexing around. Which was brilliant. And the other project that I really, really liked was the Nature Trail, which was an interactive wall at Great Ormond Street Hospital in 2012. Again, just before you even listen to the podcast, just go and check them out, because I feel it sets the scene a little bit for the podcast that you're about to listen to. But it was just really nice to go around to their studio. I mean, as I said, you know, I got there at what, half six, and the studio's still buzzing on one of the hottest days of the year. And it was great. And I think part of the reason why I like them so much is just it's all work that I wish I'd done at uni. And I just never got the chance to do it for whatever reason. I wasn't in the right studio, or the tutors didn't think it was the right direction to go in. But all the work, any idea that I kind of thought I'd had, I would then see, you know, Jason Bruges on the website. They'd done something, and done something way cooler than I would have thought of. And it was just really, really... I mean, they do stuff that... I don't know, I didn't think, you know, studios could kind of do stuff like this, and it was really fun, and it's always something I wanted to do, so it was great to kind of, we nerd out a bit, you know, go into a bit of detail about what, like, programs they use and what type of stuff they use. So, and one of the other projects is they did an interactive installation for number 10 Downing Street Door. So, if you're not listening to this through Acast, just go and check them out a bit before we start. And if you are listening through Acast, then I hope you enjoy the images that I'm putting in. And listen to the end of the podcast, as usual, to find out who's on next fortnight's podcast, because it's a really good one and I'm really excited about it. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. Enjoy.
One, two.
Perfect. I won't lie to you, that is my introduction. There is no beginning to it. So,
all right, so we're just talking from here on in.
We're just talking, yeah. And I guess the structure of this will be just a very free-form chat about really anything you want to talk about, and there's lots of questions I have as well. But so it's a much more relaxed chat. I'm not going to edit it, so, you know, don't worry about answering any questions. But I have loads of questions, but you did just show me the massive lion from downstairs.
Yes.
And obviously I do a bit of research, so that was kind of the thing that kept popping up, and I'd love you to explain a bit more about it, because
the
digital lion kind of conjures up certain images, but it's actually a digital lion.
Yes. So we were commissioned by MEC, who are a agency which specialise in analysing real-time information about the world we live in, particularly around brands and their customers, in terms of what they're saying about them. And they were sponsoring an innovation line, so people from the design world that aren't familiar with the Lions, it is the sort of advertising Oscars and takes place in Cannes.
Okay.
And very prestigious event, and it's where you need to be seen to be. And we were asked to create an intervention, an installation that would represent the process they go through in terms of analysing data with respect to how brands are viewed. And this is a very much a 24/7 thing now. So brands are, you know, they're always being talked about. There's always conversations. There's always feedback.
Yeah.
And this is something which obviously is part of the work they undertake. And they were really interested in something that would bring information on the process of analysing that information out of the screen and make it physical. So we talked about creating a digital art stroke design installation which would bring that to life so that people visiting the Innovation Lion, so for the first year ever, this is a different type of lion that celebrates digital innovation, technical innovation, and within one of the within the Palais in Cannes, we built this one-to-one lion made from a cloud of small portrait-mounted screens, which viewed from a certain sort of anamorphic position represented a one-to-one adult lion in terms of size and scale, and you sort of would see the view from kind of one angle.
And the idea is that it would... You were saying it responds to social media input, so the more tweeted you were.
So from afar, you got this kind of lava lamp-esque sort of flowing colour movement, sort of dynamic changing object, which represented the amount of positive and negative and neutral sentiment in Cannes at that time. I should say near real time. We're polling a database, but it's
pretty
much...
So did you have like a live feed coming?
We had live feed coming in from Poland. MEC's team there are analysing the stats.
That's cool.
And we had a database which would say, you know, is it a positive tweet? Is it a negative tweet? Is it neutral? Therefore, there's enough words counterbalancing each other.
How do they know if it's a negative?
You can analyse words and they either have a positive or negative score.
Really?
And then you look at your 127 characters and you get a score for the whole tweet.
Right.
And therefore, you're able to analyse.
I didn't know that.
And there are different ways of doing it. You can do it based on language. You can do it based on language and human input. Anyway, the important bit really was to sort of say, look, we're creating this digital mirror for what's happening in Cannes right now.
Yeah.
So a great lecture had just finished and people would come out with positivity and lots of great things, or the awards were happening and people were really excited about it. You better see that.
So if they hashtagged anything.
Yeah, so if we were picking up hashtags with Cannes Lion, Cannes Lion 2005, Innovation Lions, MEC, us, whatever, then we were pulling from a certain series of threads. And then if you would then see a yellow flash across the line, it would be something with a positive sentiment.
Really?
A black kind of flash of graphics running across the surface of the line, it's a negative, and white was somewhere in between the two, so the neutral. So at a distance, you're able to say, oh, Cannes happy right now, or or it's quiet or busy, because it's also to do with the frequency of these sort of graphics rippling across this line made up of video pixels, so small screens. And also funny things like early in the day, people are a little bit hungover or a bit slow and it's quiet and it's a little bit more sedate. So you'd be able to sort of see
peaks and
troughs, lunch it dipped as well. So it's really interesting, and we'll be looking at the logs afterwards of how the lion, which we called a motor can, so hashtag a motor can as in emoticon.
Yeah.
So just being the emotion of Cannes at any one time. And then as you walked up to it, we actually analysed the space around the lion. So as your head came near it, the sort of graphic kind of symbols flowing across the line would then reveal the tweets behind them. So you had actually data.
So as you walk closer, it would open.
The graphics would change and transfer just to a sort of more detailed graphic.
I feel like, again, this is such a visual thing that we're talking about, and I've seen the video, so I can kind of imagine exactly what you're saying. But I post this on a thing called Acast, and The great thing is that you can listen to it on your iPhone or the podcast, but you embed videos and images inside the podcast. So I'll go back after we've recorded this. And then every time you mention a video, the video will pop up and you just click on it and it'll play. So
that's handy.
This is why I was so excited about doing this one, because we'll come onto your website later, but the amount of videos on there and the amount of content on there makes for a really good podcast. And I really hope, because you can listen to it through iTunes, it doesn't have the same effect. So listen to it through Acast. But this whole idea of you essentially have a display that can read the emotion of social media at any given time, but you must know your own stats for Twitter, right? Can you apply a Jason Bruges happy barometer?
We could, I suppose, have some interior features here in the studio, which could give us a feeling for how the world is feeling about Jason Bruges' studio.
Or your feeling before you come into work,
so they know how to treat you. Or how the team are feeling. It could be a whole series of things. I mean, I have to say, I'm more of a sort of factual, I'm doing this, or the office is doing this, instigator within the Twitter sphere. I'm not a kind of, I'm happy or sad. I mean, you'd have to look quite closely at the type of words I'm using, how short or long the message is. I'm not a sort of...
But it opens up, all of your little videos and all the kind of installations, to me, straight away open up all the other possibilities. Well, God, I didn't even know you could do that. If you can do that, can you do this? And things like that to the other social media groups. This is all proprietary technology that you've kind of created yourself, right?
The system we designed for that project is made from a series of components that are borrowed from different industries or potentially sort of we're early adopters of them.
Yeah.
But it's the system which is the kind of first in class, the first sort of use of that thing, those objects all working together at the same time. And that's probably where we're doing something that's quite unusual because we have a workshop where we prototype and test creative digital systems.
Yeah, and also the really hard part and the bit that takes all the time is the bit that no one notices is you make it easy to consume, right? You do all that super hard work and then you put something that makes it digestible for an average person, doesn't need to understand it, it's just there in front of them. And that kind of
absolutely, I mean,
playful side is hard.
Putting something into the real world that is a rule of thumb, I think it was Bill Moggridge stated this when he first coined the term interaction design, is you've got to be at a sort of, the entry level for a lot of these things is sort of understandable in sort of under 20 seconds. So it's, you've got to engage people if you're putting things into the public realm without any interpretation. And you've got people who are going to see them every day. You've got people that are going to see them once in their lifetime. So you want different narratives to be available to different groups of people based on the type of relationship they're going to create with your work.
Do you do a lot of testing here for a perfect example, the very first project that I saw of yours in the design museum, which was the pandas. And I can't remember the name of the actual official name of
called
it.
Called Panda Eyes.
Panda Eyes, there you go. And it was really, one, I love the idea of robotics and things that interact with you, but it was just such a hilariously creepy thing to happen that suddenly 100, how many pandas was it?
It was 100 pandas.
100 pandas all slowly rotate, just rotate and stare at you. It was just really fun as well. But again, it was that quite complicated technology integrated.
Yeah.
And as you said, I got it in 10 seconds, but it had a much deeper story about the World Wildlife Fund, and you'd used a money panda, hadn't you? It had extra depth to it if you wanted to explore, but anyone could walk in, have a little smile. I guess that process must be hard because you must have quite a lot of technology here where you're like, we've thought of something brilliant. No idea how to implement that.
Yeah, I have to say, generally speaking, the idea comes first and the technology is a palette, which obviously we're developing all the time. And you're thinking about what sort of things would then work to sort of tell the story. With the pandas, which was a commission from the World Wildlife Fund, and using their iconic 60s, 70s money box, the fiberglass money box, as you say, it was when we actually started unpacking them, because I said, I want to create a network of these things. I thought they were going to talk to each other somehow, perhaps. We started laying them out and realised they looked like a little terracotta army laid out on our then, with a ping pong table in the workshop, laying them out. And secondly, I had one on my desk just to look at, and I always just felt slightly uncomfortable, this sort of glassy plastic eyes staring at me.
Yeah.
And it was just that gaze. I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if that gaze never was unbroken whilst you're walking around them? Hence the sort of tracking,
yeah,
which we then established for the whole field of them to track you as you walked around them. And Panda Eyes, really, in terms of the name, was just the sort of unsavoury things we're doing to our world, the sort of hangover, the how your eyes look the morning after sort of thing. So that was the sort of deep and meaningful bit. And then it was auctioned by Christie's for a sum of money to raise money for the World Wildlife Fund. And the bit inside that, the stepper motors driving them, spinning around again, not that kind of rocket science like, but again, making 100 of them work all at the same time, integrated at a cost we could afford to do for the kind of project it was.
Yeah.
And above that, we had a low-resolution thermal camera that was used in Tesco's to monitor the queues of people standing waiting for things, so you can estimate queue times. We'd hacked into that and used that in a way that we could actually drive the movement of the pandas based on where every single person was in the room. It's a full safe way of doing it because you don't rely on lighting conditions. You're relying on temperature at the top of the people's heads.
See, now you've just answered about 5 questions that I had. Doing the podcast, I was like, I really want to interview Jason Bruges. And I was showing people your website and I showed the Panda Eyes. And in Makes, we just got a new office and I wanted to do a window display. And obviously, I love the Panda Eyes one. And so we're doing one called Mini Makers, which is like little make people that track your eyes. And I had no idea how to do this. And you've just kind of answered a whole series of questions because we're using a Microsoft Kinect.
Yes.
And but that was back in 2008, that Panda Eyes one. So you didn't have kind of easily available perspective technology to use. So how did you even find out about the Tesco's?
We work with sort of lots of creative technologists and boffins working in sheds who work with all sorts of extraordinary equipment and things.
So you have a kind of R&D.
So we talk to people to find out, you know, what should we use for this? And since then, we've worked with, in fact, that's a technology that's very popular. Low resolution thermal tracking is pretty useful. And it can be done not through glass, but it can be done through red perspex because it still works. And certainly we've used quite a lot of different versions of the Kinect and Carmine sensors and also low resolution, other types of low resolution point source sensors as well. So there's sort of,
have you found anything that does work through glass?
Well, the Kinect does,
yeah,
but it reduces its the power of it is reduced through glass.
Do you still get? I mean, you're running your own practice. It's 20 people. Do you still get as involved at the beginning as you? I mean, do you still get stuck in the workshop, or have you?
I tried to get involved, but really, the window of time I have to look at any one thing is massively reduced.
Yeah.
So, therefore, yeah, the hands-on bit always takes longer than you think.
Yeah.
So sort of, I'll go down and mock something up. It'll take me 2 hours. It takes you all day long.
Mm.
So I would like to do more, but at the end of the day, I'm conducting.
Yeah.
And there's a team of very talented people, most of them which are better than me at sort of programming, soldering, putting things together and mocking up. So actually, it's something I watch from afar, but I'm dabbling in and guiding and conducting and
sort looking over the shoulder.
Yeah,
Do that. So, because you worked at Foster's before you started,
yes,
didn't you?
Indeed.
And that was how long have you had your own studio?
The studio's been running since it was incorporated in 2002. We probably did some of our first projects in 2001, and I started working as a sort of artist, working with technology in 2000.
Mm.
So,
and were you an architect at Foster's then? So.
Yes, so I was an architectural assistant, which I think was the correct term.
Okay, yeah. Got to use the right terminology,
At Foster & Partners and Foster Asia.
Mm.
So working on Chetplat Cock and Citibank and HSBC in London. And then I moved to pursue more artistic endeavours, which I ended up being Imagination, working on like the Millennium Dome.
Wow, that's a massive project.
And which was the BT Pavilion there.
Mm.
And I was a senior designer and interaction designer. So self-taught as an interaction designer as a result of my period at the Bartlett working on the interaction design lab there under Professor Stephen Gage.
All right. So, what? Because I'm really interested in how your practice started, because I talk to my friends a lot, and our dream is always to start our own practice. And to get the opportunity to talk to someone who has run their own practice, did you ever set out to think, do you know what, I want to do my own practice? Or was it, I want to do my own projects, just kind of on my own? Or were you always like, no, I want to work with other people? Because
I think it was really came out of, it was an evolution.
Mm.
And I had a skill set that was architectural and technological and artistic. And it was, how am I going to make a living doing these things? And I think I got closest to sort of sorting that out in my head whilst I got to imagination. Because I saw a world that was a very different multidisciplinary world.
Mm.
Had an R&D department, projectionists, people with graphics, multimedia, all these things that are very different. And projects very quick, very theatrical. Yeah. And I was thinking, oh, this is quite different to an architectural setup. Very interesting to see how that works. And the way a more agency-like environment sells itself, really interesting.
Mm.
So I learned a lot from that. And blending.
What do you mean an agency sells itself? As in,
well, the sort of selling and pitching is very different to how an architecture practice pitches and sells itself. And I just found that kind of really interesting. It wasn't a right and a wrong, but it's a very different model.
And it's different, and as in,
it's just how
more you can do kind of whatever you want.
How you go about it. And also, you're selling a much wider process. You're selling kind of identity of things. You're trying to solve different problems potentially. And I was just fascinated by that and how that worked. And then those two worlds sort of collided, really. And I started working on personal projects for friends.
Mm.
And weekends were too short.
Yeah. So that kind of developed into your kind of first few projects. But at what point did you go, okay, weekends and evenings aren't enough now. It's time to quit my job and start my own practice? Because
I think it's by the time I had a couple of big projects just happening, really. And I had a project for T-Mobile, which didn't actually get built, and one for the hospital club that didn't get built.
Wow.
But they were two big enough things.
Yeah, those are two pretty good indicators.
So I thought, you know, there's something going on here that's interesting. And, you know, I happened to be the right place at the right time where I could afford to take the risk.
And is this out your house, home, garage?
I was working out my bedroom.
Nice. That's the most romantic idea I can think of.
Romantic, apart from the fact that you're working at your desk with things on your bed, and then you move things off your bed to go to sleep and backwards and forwards. And I was using our living room as a workshop. So I was routing, machining, programming, soldering. And I was living in a shared house at the time.
I'm sure you were very popular.
Extremely. It did mean I cleaned up probably most of the place, you know, most of the time. But not be how it's remembered. But
I'm imagining some very irate people in your house while you're sanding and routing.
Yeah,
at 3 in the morning. It's for a pitch tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
and then when did you think, okay, I think I can make, I'm gonna get a studio. Because that's a big thing.
It was some friends sort of said, look, you've just got to set up a studio.
Out of our house.
And it'd be better if you sort of move out. And it was some friends from Imagination, actually, there was a really cute sort of designer maker studio in Rotherhithe. So I had a little tiny studio there overlooking the Thames.
That's awesome.
And, you know, it was heavily subsidised by Southwark, who had sort of kind of put a rent cap on the building.
Oh, really?
So it was just a really interesting place to sort of start off. And then we managed to last about a year, 18 months there before the landlord managed to sort of rebrand the building and refurb it and things. But
and was it just you, or did you have kind of extra?
I had a couple of people. I had a couple of students coming in. I had an accountant and I had a sort of part-time assistant. So that was pretty much it. I think I did assistant and accountant straight away because I thought there's two things that I just don't do. No. I mean, I do, but I just need help with those things.
They're so boring as well. Why waste your time on that? See, because I went to David Batchelor, an artist and over in Bow, and went to his studio, and he's only been there for a couple of months or whatever, but it's another one of those big group studios, and it's a big warehouse. It's such a cool place to be because every door you looked in was like a little Aladdin's cave. It was like walking through five different movie sets. Every room I looked in had different things being built. And that's quite I'm sure being in your bedroom is inspirational to a certain extent, but being around other people in that mindset who've got other ideas and stuff must be be great,
I mean,
right?
That was great. I mean, you walk past door and the everything from wedding dresses to ceramics to all sorts of wonderful things happening there.
Because as well, a huge part of what you're doing is actually making bits and pieces from scratch as well. So it's not like architecture where you have to pick things off the shelf. Go and make it. Go and make these little displays. Go and make it. And so I guess you have to learn a bit of everything, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, with our team now, we have either on call or within the core team, we have design engineers, industrial designers, interaction designers, software and coding specialists, architects, lighting designers, 3D designers, and people with all sorts of weird and wonderful hybrid skills. We've had civil engineers in here. We've had people with set design. We've had sort of chemists, musicians, all sorts of people in the team that have a wide range of skills.
And so the process, when you get a project in, does like, I guess you have people running their own projects, but then you've got such a diverse range of skills that at any one point they go, I need your help, I need your help. And you just, everyone pitch in.
It's very much like that. I mean, we try and sort of establish a sort of team lead on it very early on so they can liaise with the client and any fabricating and internally and help organise that, a bit like a project architect.
Yeah.
And that's how we work, but it's very much a team effort. So you could be leading one project and asking from the sort of mix of help one day. Next day, you might be the specialist help on another project.
Guys, it's quite a lively office. It's not like you're stuck on one project. What's the average time span of a project? Because it's
So the Emoticon project was probably 3 or 4 months.
Is that just from getting the first go for it to having to develop?
Absolutely. And there are projects we're working on a project in Toronto at the moment, which is in collaboration with Norman Foster, and it's for Toronto Transit Commission. So it's a new underground station and we're creating an artwork there. And we think started 2008, 2009, and we're on site. We'll be on site later this year and it'll be open next year, hopefully. So
that's eight years.
We're doing some work in the Olympic Park legacy pieces in and around the South Park, and they're probably going to be up and running the same time as the stadium and then one other after Crossrail. So again, we started on those in 2008 as well. So they're some of the long ones, but typically I would say probably our average project length is about 18 months, 2 years.
That's actually okay. I thought they would... Because I was listening to, during my due diligence and research, I was listening to your Westminster talk, and you were saying that they're much more condensed, hyper-accelerated little projects. And I was trying to work out, like, is it... Because I've just been working on Broadgate, which has been like 4.5 years or something, and it would be nice to work on a slightly shorter project. But I guess the stresses are different. You've got 4 months to do, you know, something that's going to be seen by thousands of people, and it has to work seamlessly. And I guess the testing phase alone, you know, it's not like you've just soldered the last piece of wire and then ship it off. I guess there's a whole range of you being in here and making sure it works. And so, yeah, it's kind of...
Yeah, absolutely. The testing is paramount. Building bits of things is paramount.
Mm.
And as you say, some things are immovable deadlines. So construction sites will slip, as we know. Not always, but sometimes. But when you work on things like the Olympics, so we did build we worked on a pavilion for Coca-Cola. We worked on the interior space. And the Olympics were when they were. That, I have to say, was probably one of the most sort of daunting time-based projects we'd worked on. And we built a system, again, that was very, very bespoke.
That was the rotating lights, wasn't it?
Exactly. They're sort of opening, closing bubbles, so mechatronic pixels that responded to the soundtrack by Mark Ronson and the building, people moving around the building, and we had furniture scanning the environment to work out where people were and what they were doing.
Yeah.
And this sort of voxel array of bubbles was responding to all that activity.
You know, how Facebook mines data? You know, you were saying in Coca-Cola, there's thousands of people coming in and out. Do they use the information? Because you would know how many people are coming in, how many people are going out, where they're going.
Well, they'll know how many people are going in and out. So they'll have visitor numbers, because that's an important return on investment sort of conversation in that kind of scenario. They'll they'll have, I dare say, they'll have some metrics on that as well, in terms of rough age and gender and, you know.
I don't know why they hadn't thought of that themselves, yeah.
But, obvious. but a lot of the pieces we're doing, we can now obviously do that sort of digitally. We've got a piece live in Toronto at the moment called Back to Front, which is a piece commissioned by a Tridel condominium developer on Front Street West. And it was to bring a little pocket park to life. It's part of their 1% for art and for the city. And the granite monoliths, there are six of them across the little park, and they basically sense any shadow. So the idea for the piece came from the shadows being cast across the park. I was up the top of the CN Tower and looking at these vast shadows coming from different skyscrapers crisscrossing the urban landscape. I thought, wouldn't it be great to create an artwork that can respond to those shadows? So the surface is actually a whole grid of circular glass discs which are able to emit light but also perceive the light incident upon them. So we have these light sensitive surfaces. Now the nice thing is they're actually running live, and we're actually able to see the patterns of light that actually occur each day on the site here in London. So through a process I call the Internet of Art rather than the Internet of Things, we're able to we're able to see what these works are doing, and we're able to see where people walk, where they go to the east or the west side of the piece of artwork, and what kind of shadow they're casting, and we can sort of kind of work out what kind of day it is. If it's overcast, whether the sun is directly shining upon it.
So if it's overcast, you get very poor kind of definition, and if it's really sunny, you
And we can work that out by looking at how the shadows are cast onto the artwork.
The Internet of Art. Is that something you can say is yours? Can you claim
I've not heard that phrase come from anywhere before.
I think you should claim it.
That's, and that's my third time I've used it.
Okay, well, there you go. So you, that's claimed. See, my my friend Craig works lives in Toronto. So whereabouts in Toronto is it?
Front 300 West Front Street.
Do you hear that, Craig? There you go. You can go and take photos.
Go and have a look. It's their granite monoliths. They're made from local Torontonian granite, and they... we even tested them in freezers in Cambridge.
That's as close as you can get to Canadian. Kind of.
So we basically tested the Torontonian window, the winter, the freeze-thaw cycles, the kind of silt coming in, impact from hockey sticks, all of the above we tested.
And did it pass?
It passed. Day? I mean, we managed to break things and obviously then improve the design, but all the kind of interfaces between glass and granite and electronics were tested for those sort of 40, 50 degree swings in temperature.
Man, that's some intense testing. So how long does it take to test something? So you go, okay, well, we need it for Christmas. And then do you allow like 6 months to like kind of test it and crack it?
Hi. Yeah. We need quite a reasonable amount of time to test things.
I've not even factored in, like, again, total naivety towards making these things. But
you know, we can work out how much risk there is around the sort of testing process.
And how, like, I guess when we specify stuff architecturally, they have to last for a certain amount of time. Not all of your projects are temporary, but I imagine the majority of them...
Yeah, so like Back to Front in Toronto, we talked about an 80-year design life of the sort of main bits of granite and steel with a 10-year design life for the electronics. So it gets swapped out on little cassettes every 10 years. But typically, quite often, we'll be following a 25-year design life for the permanent pieces. And for the more temporary pieces, obviously, you know, it's for the length of the filming or the event.
Mm.
But quite often people go, oh, I would like a little bit of that. Yeah. So like, for example,
I bet they do.
The little mechatronic... mechanical flippers we created for More 4.
They're really cool, yeah.
And they were built just for the filming over a week. But then Channel 4 turned around and said, we'd love to have some in our foyer as sort of like a kind of feature.
Wow.
So interesting. Then something you design in 6 weeks and put together for some filming as part of a prop for a set is then suddenly... you know, someone's going, oh, can we actually have it for a sort of something that might last for 3 years? So you always get these sort of, you know, it's a good problem to have, but then you've got to sort of explain what kind of design engineering and industrial design and thinking and mechanical engineering has got to go into that object to then make sure it's ruggedized enough and has the right redundancy built into it for then to have another life.
Because it must be hard to explain to a client, slightly more complicated. You can't just increase.
We've got a beautiful thing here, and it works, and it looks everything. But actually, we've then got to go into quite a few of those components, re-spec them, test them, re-prototype them to go through like a million operations rather than 10,000 operations. Yeah. And they go, "Oh, really?"
And they're "Jason, no, you're pulling my leg now. No,
we're going to reach." And I'll say, "Well, look, we're going to reach 10,000 operations like in 10 days or a day, depending on what it is."
Yeah, again, problems that you can't foresee, and then you can't know how long the life of a product is and stuff. But going back to, because I wanted to, I want to talk about Toronto Stone, because you were talking about it in your lecture, and you were saying it was, it's funny watching people interact with these stone stuff to see, because they can't see what they're doing. It's the people on the other side of the stone.
Yeah, we designed the piece, and it's called Back to Front for a reason. Because we realise most of the pieces we designed that are mirror-based is quite a common phenomenon in digital art, to look at the idea of the digital mirror.
Mm.
And in fact, we first saw this phenomenon when we were commissioned by the Victoria and Albert Museum to create Mirror Mirror for their big Decode exhibition in 2009. And there, I sort of counted a dozen digital mirrors, and I thought we were being sort of clever and unique, and we were, of course, one of many.
Mm.
And whilst we were doing something quite interesting with water and sort of secondary reflections and refractions, and looking at the whole idea of sort of narcissism and things being captured by water, but it made me think, well, I want to do something a bit different. So this time we're going to transfer that silhouette to the other side, and then it becomes something that is experienced by an audience that's of the other side of the artwork. So it's very much about sort of transgressing this kind of front and moving through the stone, and it being actually in times being quite collaborative in terms of two people being able to see each other's silhouettes, but not getting the kind of direct feedback.
Because what drives you to do these? Is it the fun of watching people interact with these things? Because a lot of the ones are kind of interactive, aren't they? Some of them are. I guess they're interesting to watch. Like the Channel 4 one is beautiful to watch, isn't it? But the ones where you see people jumping around and stuff, is that what really interests you, people's interaction with these?
I think really, until something comes alive, like people like seeing the line for the first time and working out where it resolved as an image, or those moments of discovery, I think are just the most wonderful things, where you sort of just see that recognition, or sort of engaging someone and seeing the delight in that process. Or, for example, watching our environment at Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children, basically catching the children's eye. We have animals running through a half-tone forest, which is on the route from ward to surgery, and just seeing that sort of moment of distraction and just adding a little bit of lightness to that otherwise sort of serious journey and sort of quite functional journey for some of the children. And that interaction really is what brings these things to life. I mean, without people, and the same sort of buildings aren't necessarily that interesting, but whilst they might be beautiful monuments or artistic sort of statements, they only come to life with people. And the same is for our work, really, the studio's work, whether it be a design commission or an art commission.
I'm really glad you said that, because you're saying people need to understand it in 20 seconds. That's the amount they need to take. So my litmus test is if my wife likes it and thinks it's interesting. She's a teacher. If she gets it, then I know it's a universally acceptable thing, because I've dragged around so many buildings. Her tolerance for architecture is absolutely zero. So when she saw the Great Ormond Street, she's a primary school teacher, and she just thought, because she just saw the video playing in the background that I was watching on my laptop, and she thought it was absolutely amazing. And and she loved the whole story behind it. And I've been trying to work out why I like installation so much and why I'm so drawn. There's kind of a few websites I really like. Yours is obviously a very prominent one. And I think it's the element of surprise. You can surprise people. And I think in architecture, it doesn't have the same immediate impact. And it's a very static, unmoving thing. And I love architecture, but the ability to surprise someone, especially because I think some of the ones that I liked of yours are ones that you don't necessarily know they're there, and they kind of catch you by surprise. And that's the best part, right? I guess that's why I like reading magazines, things like Blueprint and stuff. You turn the page and there's like a wow image, right? And it's like an interactive display. And because I did my sixth year dissertation and I used a lot of your work, and I was like, I want to do like an interactive wall. And my tutor, who will remain nameless, was like, that's not architecture. You can't do an interactive wall. So I got steered away from it. And then it's so nice to come back and get to a chance to interview, you know, 6 years later and think, no, it is, you know, you can, it is architecture, but design and architecture, but it's that, I don't know, the more interesting side.
It is interesting because I did get asked, I think when I was trying to think when I got asked, but the other day, and it's a question that keeps cropping up, and when are you going to do a building, Jason?
Yeah,
which I bet is quite it does, an interesting one. But I would sort of say, well, some of our pieces are enclosures and are sort of like pavilion-like. Mm. So we're kind of getting there without really having the same sort of functional requirements.
Yeah, I'm glad
Well, they are actually, because they've got to be waterproof. They've got to resist the sort of rigours of use. And
I would say that actually I think you'll find the stuff we design is significantly more complicated than just a house. Yeah. Anyone can do a house insulation. You try making that move and rotate at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and a whole set of new multidisciplinary inputs.
Yeah, it's easy designing a house anyway.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Blueprint, because you might have seen the work we had published in Blueprint magazine, which was about the 10 Downing Street project.
During my research again, it had cropped up on my Google search. But yeah, tell me more about that.
So that again, at a very house-like scale, which actually number 10 isn't really a house. It's an extraordinary theatre set. It is amazing.
It's huge, isn't it? Yeah, it just goes on.
it's a wonderful kind of sort of apparition of things. And yeah, we got invited to work on the front door. And this came out of a conversation we're supporting and commissioned by the great team who are celebrating British creativity and innovation around the world and basically trying to get people to buy more of it. Also visit Britain and learn and study about it. Visit Britain in terms of tourism and buy British products and creative ingenuity and all of these things. And they wanted something that was a sort of living, breathing, interactive piece they could commission that was dynamic, which they could use for their campaign, but not on posters. It's going to be on the web and the kind of films we made of it. And they needed an iconic site. And we were sitting there at number 10. They said, what about the door? And I said, what do you mean, what about the door? Well, can we create an installation on the door? And I said, okay, I wrote down, I said, door, yeah, great idea. And we talked about a few other ideas as well and came back to it a few weeks later. And they said, yeah, we think we might be able to do the door and that might work. And I was like, that's extraordinary. Is that something we can really do? And we went through probably 3 or 4 months of security protocol. And
dear David.
And we had to name our teams quite early on as well. So, for example, probably 3 or 4 months before we were on site, these are the people that are installing it and hoping everyone's going to be kind of fit on the day. And then basically there's an opportunity that became available where the door is swapped over for routine maintenance. So a new coat of lacquer and just to check that it's all right. And it's obviously, well, a nice secure door. And end of January this year, the door is being replaced and they allowed for a bigger window of not having this big secure door where we could put our sort of digital replica of the door, so it allows you to see through it. So there is again a whole array of sensors and pixels within it that see what's behind it and show it's active camouflage, is a technical term.
Is it still up now?
It's now touring the world. I think it's on somewhere between London and Mexico, Milan, I forget which, but it's been to Shanghai, Suzhou, Paris. And it's part of the Great Creations exhibition to sort of talk about.
How cool is that?
It's on tour with Aston Martin and a Mulberry bag, and I think some rather fabulous portraits of the Queen by David Bailey. So there's sort of quite an interesting sort of spread of different sort of artifacts it's sort of on tour with. But it was a collaboration with Benchmark, who make fantastic joinery and furniture, and we wanted something that would evoke the quality, and this is really important about our work, it evoked the quality of the actual door. So we got tulip wood with nearly as many coats as lacquer and paint as the real thing, same door furniture, but under all of this we've embedded this sort of digital composites which will allow us to sort of sense,
so like movement. Tiny little cameras and stuff and sensors,
yeah,
are all kind
sensors
of
all built in. And for those interested in the geekery behind this, we've got a Raspberry Pi inside the door, force ventilation making all of that work.
No way.
But it's a tulip wood frame. and otherwise looks exactly like the black glossy door. It's very, very mirrored. So had a lot of fun filming that. And if you look at that online, you'll see me walking up, pretending to be visiting David. And you'll see the policeman come up from behind the door and you'll see his silhouette. And then you'll see me going in. Then you see me dancing behind the door. So dancing in number 10 foyer.
I thought you said when the policeman come up, you see him grab me, haul me away. But did you ever think, so it's 2015. So 15 years ago, you started the studio or getting on for 14. Mm. Do you ever sit down and go, God, you know, I've just done number 10 Downing Street door. This is, do you ever think back or does it seem so gradual that you kind of don't reflect like that?
I mean, it's getting gradual and it's sort of quite interesting to sort of see where our work is being positioned to make difference and where people are inviting for us to create interventions. And I think intervention is a good word because it's about making difference to the arty sort of definition of intervention is making difference to an environment as it stands now through sort of physical or artistic intervention.
Yeah.
There's a different meaning in politics, but this is the artistic kind of meaning of the word. So, you know, this year, you know, to work on the Downing Street door and the top 40 stories of the Shard is sort of quite an interesting scale of
good contrast of scales there, haven't you? Because again, doing my research, I noticed that you... Part of you, I guess, expanding the online presence of your studio, you employed, I can't remember the name of the company, but someone to kind of, their specific role was to actively engage your work and increase your presence. So that must have been a...
You might be talking about a company called Semaphore, I believe. Yes.
And so again, like a conscious decision by yourself that... I guess we've got all this work, this massive catalogue work, but we need to kind of push its... The only reason I ask is because I'm doing the podcast and I'm really interested in like, oh crap, how do people know where to go or how to listen to it?
When it's published, you know, these guys will say, well, you've got to tweet this time of day because there's the most people listening to Twittersphere, or if it's in your newsletter, I think like Tuesday morning's good, Friday morning's good, Friday afternoons, you know, it's all these conversations about when you put things out, when you publish them. Don't do it 2 a.m. because it'll get just lost in someone's inbox.
Yeah.
You might think you're being incredibly efficient and clever, but you've actually got to be very, very precise. And it really intrigues me, the design and the kind of thinking behind just publishing work.
Yeah, because again, it must be like another process that you can, like your lion at the can, you know, you've seen how you can dial into Twitter and it's such a massive thing. There must be, what did you call it? The Internet of Art.
Yes.
Ding. That's coined. that kind of idea that you can, well, one, increase the presence of your studio, but there's like, there must be, are you kind of looking at what's next? Like, what else are you looking to do? Is there more internet stuff or?
Well, I think, again, I mean, I did quite a lot of talks about 2 or 3 years ago about the Internet of Things. People talking about intelligence embedded in objects and networks of objects talking to each other. But however, I then realised I've been doing it for 20 years, building bits of intelligent buildings and them talking to each other. So it's not really a new thing, but it's the organisation of it and it's certainly the sort of how it's publicised and talks about. So, you know, it's just understanding how to describe that to people and how they can sort of understand it, really.
Because I am, again, so going back to the kind of, the development of your studio, I'm always really interested in, was it clear to you, you're thinking, right, after 10 years we've been going, how do I, did the practice have a plateau? Did you think, oh, I'm not getting as much work in, or we need more in, or I want to grow and expand,
I think the sort of plateaus we've had are the same as everyone else's plateaus, so they're financial.
Yeah.
And therefore, world markets changing quite rapidly, very quickly, or world events happening that mean people put things on pause, are a significant force. I mean, we're lucky, we're cross-sector, we're working in 22 countries currently, or have been.
That's a good spread of projects, isn't it?
So there's a sort of, you know, you can have bad luck and things can turn on and off, but you can sort of spread the risks. And therefore, I think, the only plateaus have happened. I think, you know, 2008 was not, we had a lot of work, but suddenly a lot of the big things dried up very quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we re-established things, but it was a wake-up call. And I think to a smaller degree, it happened very at the very beginning as well, where two big things I thought were going to happen didn't.
Mm.
But, you know, you get on with it and you work out to read those signals quicker, faster, better, and also to spread the risk.
Yeah. Have you found that spreading it across countries means that... Do you notice our work's gone down in one country, work's picking up in another?
You will notice that. So we were very lucky and had cleverly exploiting the opportunities in Canada whilst they did not get into the same situation with respect to the sort of banking crisis in 2008.
Mm.
So we had a lot more work in Canada. Now the work in US is picking up a lot more, and it's sort of the balance is changing. In the UK, depending whether things are privately funded or publicly funded, has changed quite a lot, just within terms of the sort of financial setup.
Yeah.
So the work we once got originally through sort of publicly funding thing is now a lot more through privately funded things currently.
Yeah.
But obviously, that change is based on the kind of political, the setup and how where money's going to really, and who's looking at who can fund things.
So do you get... Having worked in 22 countries means that you must... I take it you go to Canada regularly and go around, or is that why you are a slightly larger team who take it in turns?
Well, I like to give people opportunities to go and see and do things.
Very
and
politically.
It gives people inspired, and they've got to sort of see the kind of environments we're installing the things. They've got to meet the clients. So it doesn't really make much point for me to go that often. Obviously, clients every now and then go, like to see Jason, or we have a moment in time.
Yeah.
Where, you know, quite often I'm pitching and or looking at sort of key moments of projects. But ideally, it's the team going to see these things. They're working on it. It's, it's their baby at the end of the day.
That's cool.
So it's good for them to see it, really.
And do they go out for weeks at a time then?
Last year we had a team in Beijing and a team in Toronto for quite long periods of time, like 3-4 weeks at a time, months at a time, actually, in Beijing.
Really? Wow. So any... You wouldn't ever set up a studio. Did you set up a temporary studio or like...
So we've technically had a temporary studio, certainly in Beijing. And I should add, and in Toronto, we've been there a lot. We nearly have in New York, but that we were sort of more a person on the ground liaising with the sort of different opportunities in terms of new business.
Mm.
Having said that, we do technically have a second studio in Glasgow currently.
Oh, really?
Full time.
What are those guys working on then in Glasgow? Is there a specific reason that they've gone out there?
The designer, Ellie Lakin, who's in Glasgow, she moved there and we decided it would be a good idea to sort of take space there. And she's been working on a lot of the Canadian projects, for example, so it didn't matter whether she flew from Glasgow or London and she could still carry on working from Glasgow. And actually, that's sort of, I'm going to Dundee next week to go and look at some opportunities there and there might be some other opportunities in Glasgow. So I'm half Scottish, so it kind of makes sense and feels quite at home. Many family holidays spent in Scotland. So it's actually been not something that's been planned, but it's sort of evolved that way.
That's really cool. So what are there areas that you haven't got into that you really want to? I mean, how many projects have you done? Like 300 or something?
We've done about 300 or 400 projects.
We're doing all right. Yeah. But are there ones that you go, I really wish we could do that project? But
I suppose out of the 2,000 we've worked on, we've built 300 or 400 of them. So there are probably some in that mix we would have liked to have realised. Some very large, extraordinary media facades on very large towers. It's you know, we're working on a project in San Francisco where the whole city could interact with the top of the new tower there, and it was just, you know, it's just really interesting to think of that scale. How can people understand this work and interact with it at city scale? It's about urban design. It's a new type of urban design.
Yeah,
and I think that's kind of really interesting. And how then we get drawn into master planning and thinking about wayfinding and how you make spaces, and that is something new which we're getting drawn into on quite an interesting scale. So that's just something that's developing that I'm very interested in and keen to see more of. I've sort of joked, but not without some kind of backing, that we'd like to sort of see projects at certain orbits around this planet. So, I mean, I think that there are opportunities for sort of communication and observation projects that
you're going to be ambitious,
literally in near space or space. So we're not going to stop anywhere, really. It'd be really nice to sort of explore lots of different types of environments.
Because I was thinking, the advantage a studio has now, you know, you've got such a kind of big background of projects, is you were saying that when you did the digital reflection artworks, and, you know, actually there was quite a few people having done similar things, but now you guys can work at a scale and achieve projects of a scale that kind of puts you in a much smaller category of practices that can achieve.
I'm lucky to say I've had some brilliant people work for me, and some of them have gone on to set up their own things, and that's obviously a sign of just, you know, people that are kind of really interested. And there are, obviously it's a genre of work that's exploding because of the technology being ubiquitous.
Yeah, exactly.
But nothing is going to change track record and having built things at a certain scale.
Yeah.
And also having seen, you know, it's very well putting things into galleries or having temporary work, but we're now going back to look at work we finished 10 years ago and refurbing it and updating it and things. Mm. So having that track record of seeing work. So like, for example, we're working on Litmus, which is a piece we have on the A13 running out of London. Mm-hmm. And we're currently refurbishing that for Havering Borough Council. So it's sort of new LED clusters, new brains, that type of thing, clean up, rethink about some of the things. But it's invaluable to learn from your past.
Yeah, I bet it is. As
whilst you're moving forward, and that knowledge and know-how and process is sort of extraordinarily useful. And if you don't learn from that, and also if you're not making mistakes or you're not improving things, you're not kind of moving forward.
I mean, again, clients must love the fact you're like, well, not only can we achieve that scale, you can go to one that's 10 years old, still working, still kind of...
And I think also the different affiliations we have are interesting. So I'm a member of BAFTA, so we sort of work on the edges of sort of film and TV. We're obviously very architectural studios, so the built environment. We are obviously liaising and working with lots of clients in the advertising industry. And then just our experience within sort of physical computing and spatial interaction design means that we get drawn into those worlds, and that those skills are being called upon. Yeah. So recently, for example, like working on the Tate Modern Bloomberg Connects project was really interesting because it was about a visitor experience and designing something that's an interface for a building that has a function.
Yeah.
And we're no longer creating an art installation. It's a design installation. It's something that's just got to work. It's doing a job. It's attracting people to the Tate Modern. It's attracting people to interact with the collections.
Yeah.
They're data mining the people that are talking to it. We're contributing our own drawings to the collection through the people that are interacting with the devices. And so that's sort of a new journey as well, actually being sort of commissioned as experiential designers, as people designing sort of visitor experiences. And it's interesting new field.
Because I'm just jealous of the projects that you work on, which is why I was like going through your website today going, you worked with Aston Martin, worked with Dyson, worked with Channel 4. You know, clients who, I guess that, you know, they're very aware of how much things cost, but they're also very aware of the kind of allure of something entertaining and the kind of visual side of everything. Whereas a lot of the clients that make have a very serious developers and things, and I guess the fun side isn't there as much. That's not to kind of naively say all your projects are just fun, but they all look, I don't know, they have a, they just, especially I'm so bad at names there, is it Wind for Light? It's the one you had
Wind to Light, sorry.
And I had ideas doing my dissertation. I was like, wouldn't it be great if Jason Bruce has done it done it better, and like just the idea of having lots of propellers on the roof that lit up at night. I love the idea of having you know, in Gladiator, he runs his hands through the corn, but they light up as they come past. But you'd done it with sticks with wind on the top, and I remember going down there and seeing it and just thinking, he gets paid for that. That's not fair. While I'm doing insulation details and like doing setting out steps and stuff, and I just thought, just every time I go on the website, you must kind of feel.
Well, I mean, you know, I think, you know, keeping buildings warm and ventilated so that we don't kind of overstep our kind of footprint, steps that are set out so you don't jar your knees. you know, things like that, they're so incredibly important. And
you think, you know, such a rosy picture.
And all of that sort of detail,
yeah,
and that, which is like, which I got from my architectural training and my experience, we put into the projects that are fun, but that sort of seriousness is there either in the narrative or certainly in the sort of production.
Yeah.
So, again, at the end of the day, if we create that kind of outcome, which is about kind of joy, it's about fun, it's about engagement, it's about creating catalysts for conversation about our environment. If that's happening, that's brilliant. And, and obviously, that's what we're aiming to do.
Do you, with children, do you, has that changed your kind of view on how you, do you want your kids to kind of, you know, wow, and I designed that, or are you, is that in the back of your head, you know, this kind of more cartoon like playful, you know, with the Great Ormond Street, you know, the animals running in the background, that's that was obviously geared towards children, but
I think I'm sure subliminally,
have you regressed more childish is what I'm basically saying since you've had kids.
I think that there may be sort of a more playful nature to what we're doing, but I think it's always been there, so it might bring it, might be bringing it out more. Certainly, it means it was some great sort of engineers for prototyping and testing. I have three of them, so they can come and look at things. And certainly, I bring the odd thing home and show it to them, and they sort of interact with it.
A good test to see how rugged your buildings are. Like, they must just try and rip stuff to pieces in 5 seconds.
Exactly. Just leave something out and don't tell them not to touch it, and then see what happens.
Well, we're coming up to the hour mark, so I'll wrap things up now. But I did want to. So I've done three podcasts. So I've done one with Assemble Studios, one with David Batchelor, and one with Studio Weave. And each one that I've interviewed has had a slightly... Assemble Studios and David Batchelor didn't really engage very much in social media. And then Studio Weave, they do a bit. But you guys, I was wondering, is that an important side of your studio? Do you engage much with it? Is it more just... by the way, we're doing this gallery.
I think it's just an important part of our communication repertoire. So if you want to talk to the modern world, you're of course going to engage with it. It doesn't sort of affect everything we do, and there's no substitute. And I've learned this through projects like the projects in Beijing for meeting people face to face and telling them about it.
Yeah.
And there's no substitute for walking across a room when you're about to send an email to a colleague. You've got to really work out how communication works. And okay, these give you greater coverage, greater visibility, and certain people will only work in a certain way.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, you've got to remember that quite often the sort of more primitive, not sort of conventional forms of communication work the best. But it's part of our repertoire.
Yeah.
You can't ignore it. It's massively important.
So you do feel like you should have it.
I find it's really interesting. I'm sort of fascinated by it, especially since I'm not generation whatever I should be to be doing it natively from you know, three or 4 years old. But at the same time, you know, I kind of understand and interact with it, but you know, not as much as I should possibly. But then at other times, you know, I'm trying to use everything in a balanced way.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So we use Twitter. I don't use Facebook as much because I sort of see it as more of a personal thing.
Yeah, okay,
but, you know, people have different views on that. We're sort of Instagramming things. We're putting things out on Vines.
Must be great for you guys.
It's really, really good for little sort of interactive things. Yeah. We did, in fact, I did my first Periscope broadcast from the lion.
I don't even know what Periscope is.
So have you heard of Meerkat?
No. Nope.
It's this other version. So basically it's an opportunity to broadcast live from an event, and people can only see it whilst you're broadcasting.
Really?
So we could have done this via Periscope instead. Different format. It's nice listening to voices rather than seeing a tired me at the end of the day. but it's just a sort of different way. If we were talking about a project specifically, perhaps that we should do that another time.
Yeah. Oh, I feel out of the loop. I've never even heard of Periscope. No. Well, so hashtag, I hope I get a job in Beijing, I hope I get work in Beijing, doesn't work, and you're saying you should go out there. No substitute for human contact.
Well, I think primarily, I mean, working in China, for example, even the conference call, we worked out it was much better to negotiate contracts and move the project quicker if we just went out for dinner with a client. Really? On a regular basis. Yeah. And that's how we, next day, something will get signed off. You know, we've been waiting 6 months for. And it was just that personal interaction. They could then trust you. They didn't know us. We're a company in London. Yeah. How do we know what you do? How do you know? And it's just, and the same, the sort of mutual distrust at the beginning is tangible in both directions.
Yeah.
So it's sort of obvious, you think about it afterwards, that, well, if you've arranged some sort of WebEx conversations or Skype conversations, that's going to solve it all. It's not, but it helps. It does mean you don't fly as much, perhaps, and it does mean you can sort other sorts of things out. And I then had to work out, like, for example, well, I'm not going to talk to them on WhatsApp, but we need, I think, is it WeChat in China? So I then realised that I can speak to all my Chinese clients on WeChat. So, you know, you pick up these funny little things.
It's a software language and foreign languages, all sorts of things.
Oh, my word. But it's just, you know, you just adapt.
Yeah.
And as a sort of small SME in the creative sector, you've got to be really adaptable. And however sort of artistic you're coming across, however sort of small team, you've just got to be massively adaptable and flexible to these things.
Well, that was, I'm going to end on that, but that was really, really good fun. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks very much, Ben.
There we go. That was episode number 4 of the Create More podcast with Jason Bruges. Again, I've just been listening back to that, trying to put all the other editing things and put the intro in. And I really, really enjoyed doing it. I mean, I say that after every podcast, but I genuinely get a buzz out of going around to people's offices and studios and finding out one more about the studio, but one more about how they work, more about the person and how the studio started. And one of the things I was really happy about was... again, I'd never met Jason. We'd emailed, but I'd never spoken to the guy. I'd never been to studios, and he obviously didn't know me. So it was really fun, kind of, I guess you could say, winning him round. I mean, that's kind of how it felt to me anyway when doing the interview, because as you're familiar with at the beginning, I don't have an intro. I don't try and make this feel like a very formal interview. I try and keep it I always sell it like a pub chat. You know, this is, imagine if it was you interviewing someone that you were really interested in and passionate about, and you just had an hour of their time to talk. And that kind of format was really fun. And Jason Bruges had a laptop which had a lot of information on at the beginning, which he was using, and obviously, you know, he's very press savvy, and as you have to be with the practice, and as you're the main sales force behind it. So I really enjoyed trying to find, you know, trying to get through that. And at the beginning, you know, I asked him lots of questions. He had lots of information, and I really enjoy the process of chatting to him and kind of finding out more about him as a person. And then it was really fun when he suddenly kind of looked down at his laptop and suddenly realized that he hadn't been looking at it for the last like half an hour. And, you know, we'd genuinely been chatting, and it's kind of, that's what I feel is the strongest point about this podcast, is it's a genuine chat. And it, there's you know, I'm not trying to get into the publicity of a practice or anything, and I'm just genuinely interested. So that was really satisfying to try and slowly win him round at the beginning. And because, you know, who am I? I'm just a random guy who turns up, and I have no intro, and I try and sell it as a free chat. So it's always funny watching them, kind of their kind of initial reaction to when I am, there's no formal questioning. Like I don't use anything. I'm literally just sat in front of him with a microphone. I don't have any notes in front of me. I do a lot of research, and I do write a lot of notes. I don't just go in completely cold. But I try and remember it all. So it does genuinely feel like a chat, and I hope you enjoy it. And, you know, a lot of you are, and loads of you are downloading it. And, it's really satisfying to kind of see it gain some momentum, and people are saying lots of nice things, which helps. So less of me nattering, and I'm going to end by telling you who's on next Fortnite's podcast, which is episode number 5. I'm really excited about this because I didn't think I'd get an interview with him. And it is Johnny Tucker, who is the chief editor of Blueprint Magazine. If you don't know Blueprint Magazine, they are one of the biggest and most prominent architecture publications. I mean, they used to be a monthly magazine, which I absolutely loved. It was like a brilliant kind of combination of architecture design in it. It wasn't all serious as I'd been used to previously on other magazines. And I don't know if I've said this before, but I probably will mention it quite a few more times, that my third year work got published in it at university, which basically made my year. And so I've always loved that magazine, and they've just changed to they now do every 2 months they do a magazine, and it's significantly more expensive, but you get a much, much nicer magazine, or it's almost a book now. So yeah, so to end, he's on next fortnight's podcast, and I'm going around to their new studios, which they're kind of, this is why we've delayed the podcast for like the interview for a week, because they're redoing their office. And yeah, I cannot wait to find out how do you run an award-winning architectural magazine? Like, what, you know, what drives him, all the things behind it, like, yeah, all the things that I love about it, I'm going to find out. And if you have any questions you want to find out, and I'll ask him, email me at ben.stewart@playdstudio.com, and that'd be amazing. So I really hope you enjoyed that, and I can't wait for next fortnight's podcast. So thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.